Let us now discuss a strategy for emotional well-being. Growth generally proceeds automatically. Much too automatically for some people as they look with dismay at their expanding waistline or shrink from the telltale bathroom scales. The way in which the body grows through a series of stages in its development is something to marvel at and is sometimes referred to as maturation. As the word maturation describes physical growth, so the word maturity tells of the process of emotional growth. But unfortunately, emotional development is not nearly as inevitable as physical growth. Even the processes of physical growth can get out of gear, as is exemplified by a cancer cell run amok on the one hand, or a stunted body that has never grown on the other. Small wonder, then, that emotional growth, never as inevitable as physical growth, can easily be thrown out of gear. I know that I'm speaking to adults, and I want to remind you that Edward Thorndike published a book called Adult Learning, and in it he challenged the long-held notion that childhood is the time of learning, and that in adulthood the capacity to learn has been lost. It had been accepted that an old dog could not be taught new tricks, but Thorndike emphatically declared that this was wrong. Failure to learn was rarely, if ever, due to age. Dr. F. W. Borum was haunted by the fear of being too old at 40. He had an interest in writing and spasmodically contributed to religious and secular periodicals. But a conversation with a layman stirred a renewed interest in the writer's craft and the prospect of a shortened writing career. Mr. Soundy, a layman some years older than he, one day asked him his age. Learning that Borum was in his late 30s, the layman uttered a warning. "If you take my advice, you'll make the most of the next few years. You will have precious few ideas after you're 40. Borum was overshadowed by the spectre of being too old at 40. He gave his every energy to gathering material and laboriously struggled to improve his literary style by writing and constantly revising. The feeling of being too old at 40 was reflected in an essay which he wrote called 40, and in which he portrayed his fears, apprehensions, and hopes. By the time of his 40th birthday, he had completed two books. In the following years, the grand total swelled to 46 books. His creative abilities only reached their zenith after his 40th year. Experience has shown that no man need ever be too old at 40. Adults rarely fail to learn because of factors within themselves or their culture. They generally lack motivation. It has become increasingly obvious that not only can adults learn, but they must learn. To become a mature person, the adult has to realize that he's in the school of life with no point of graduation, only doors opening to new spheres of opportunity. In our discussion on this tape, we're going to face some of the difficulties of emotional development and consider 10 areas in which the pastor's growth and development must take place. In consideration of these areas, the maturing pastor is faced with 10 tasks. Here they are. 1. The pastor must avoid professional self-pity. We have spent a goodly amount of time discussing the difficulties of a minister's life, but we should be cautious lest we give a warped view of the situation. One recent writer described an ordination service in which there was so much emphasis on the sacrifice the people were making to enter the ministry that he wondered if many people didn't enter upon ministerial life with pessimistic expectations. Sure, there are problems in the ministry, but so there are in every area of life. No matter what calling you examine, you will discover the disadvantages. Consider the advantages of the ministry, the wonder of working closely with people, the respect with which they treat their minister, the opportunities for social contact that few others enjoy, the possibilities for creative work in studying and preparing sermons. So we could go on and on. Few people have the opportunities of a pastor. Let's stop engaging in professional self-pity and take a look at the positive side of our work. 2. Keep a balance to your ministry. In a recent gathering of theological students, Dr. Elton Trueblood spoke on the topic, "If I Were a Pastor." His simple presentation emphasized three things. He said if he were a pastor, he would preach. He pointed out the importance and significance of proclamation in the work of the minister, then added that the people who were against preaching were generally those who had little preaching ability. Trueblood said the second thing he would do would be to teach. He suggested Bible study and perhaps a series on the great Christian classics, such as the Practice of the Presence of Christ. By maintaining his teaching ministry, Trueblood claimed that the pastor would feed his own soul and enrich his mind. The third activity recommended by this philosopher was that the minister should set up small groups in which he would involve himself. Here was balance in ministry. John Wesley's historic ministry had balance to it. He also maintained a threefold emphasis. Wesley was fervently evangelistic. After his monumental, heartwarming experience in a society meeting in Aldersgate Street, he launched himself on a great preaching crusade, which led him into the town squares and fields of England. However, along with this fervent evangelism, Wesley had a ministry of social concerns. He established schools for the children, orphanages for the unfortunates without parents, dispensaries for the ill. He never let his concern for the souls of men blind him to the need of their bodies. The third emphasis of Wesley was on small groups. He provided his people with a variety of group experiences that ran all the way from the society at the most elemental level of association, the class meeting where people discussed their behavior, the band in which members confessed their faults one to another, and at the higher level, the select society consisting of people who were seeking perfection. Wesley participated in these groups himself. You will not be successful in every area of your ministry, but beware of the tendency to find one portion in which you function well and then emphasize so that you ignore some of the other important aspects of ministry. Keep your ministry well-rounded. 3. Control those unruly emotions. In the introduction, we saw the primitive nature of emotions and the difficulty that confronted us as we went about managing these in a modern society. In a modern civilization, emotions are more frequently a liability than an asset. Civilized society does not allow the individual to give physical expression to his hostility, and he has to learn to handle it in other ways. Hostility can be expressed openly and in a verbal manner against the source of frustration. The adolescent boy damages his father's car, and the father fumes at him in a manifestation of what we could call direct hostility. A person may direct hostility towards himself. The clerk makes a foolish mistake and knows that there will be trouble. He develops a sick headache, and it may be said to be a case of repressed hostility. Another way of dealing with hostility is to express it in some way, such as chopping wood, playing golf, talking to an understanding friend, or having a session of counseling. Expressed hostility describes these activities. Possibly the most troublesome method of handling hostility is to express it openly, but not against the original source of frustration. The man in trouble at work goes home and takes it out on his wife and children, thus displaying what we might call displaced hostility. Displaced hostility occurs under a number of circumstances. If the source of frustration constitutes a danger to the individual, as with the boss who has power to dismiss him, or if the individual has ambivalent feelings toward the person who thwarted him, as when a dependent wife vents her hostility on the children rather than on her inconsiderate spouse, hostility is displaced. Displacement may also occur when the source of frustration is unknown or inaccessible. For the frustrated individual, a single cause, like the government, becomes a target. An individual must continue to grow emotionally, but fixations and conditioning processes thwart emotional growth. Wayne Oates uses the term dated emotions. Early in life, a child learns to dominate the situation by screaming, kicking, or holding his breath until he's blue in the face. So comes the evolution of a technique of manipulating others. Faced with conflicts in later life, emotions blaze and dominate, with rationality rapidly receding. 4. Be circumspect in your counseling. Nowhere is the pastor's emotional nature more vulnerable than in the area of his counselling ministry. The tragedy of all of this is that counselling is the area within which the pastor is trying to give personal help to his church member. The difficulty in this situation is the potential for emotional involvement, which is always present. In a counselling relationship that is something more than at a superficial level, some type of emotional involvement almost invariably develops. Some psychologists speak about the mechanism of transference, which is the process whereby a counselee shifts emotional feelings which apply to someone else onto the counselor. Negative transference means that in the counseling situation, the emotionally upset person projects his hostile feelings onto the counselor and frequently becomes antagonistic towards him. A pastor, anxious to maintain good relationships with his parishioners, is distressed as the subject becomes negative and hostile. He feels that after all his work to help someone, he is unappreciated. The positive transference presents yet another aspect of the problem. In this type of experience, the counselee becomes attached to the counselor, seeking and offering love. This positive transference is many a pastor's Achilles heel. Remember that in your efforts to help a counselee, you may deal them an awful injury and find yourself like Samson of old with your hair shorn. Many pastors are avoiding the problem of transference by using groups for counselling. In the type of therapy which I personally use, generally known as integrity therapy, we maintain it is only necessary for the counsellor to have one individual session with a counsellee before moving the individual into a group. In this type of counselling, the pastor's wife provides an excellent resource. After the pastor has had one session, he can suggest, "Would you mind if we invited my wife to join us?" Most wives would be delighted to be involved in this process and would provide a means of starting a group, and as the number gradually grew, your wife could drop out if she didn't want to continue in the process. I suggest that you pay careful attention to the possibility of using groups in your counselling. This will give you not only better counselling, but it may help to save you from some of the potential situations which may cause you so much difficulty. 5. Cultivate the life of your family. The Bible tells us the church is like a family. The elders are fathers. The older women are mothers. The younger men are brothers. The younger women are sisters. The leader of the church family must look to his own family life. The very first Protestant parsonage was established in Germany. It was the home of the great reformer Martin Luther. Luther prized family life, and Bainton notes that for Luther, the family became the school of character. In Luther's family life, he became increasingly aware of family problems and often discussed such matters as the daily concern for earning a living, difficulty in pregnancy, and the problems of child rearing. On one occasion, he cried in exasperation, "Child, what have you done that I should love you so? You disturb the whole house with your bawling." When a crying child kept him awake at night, he sighed. This is the sort of thing that caused the church fathers to vilify marriage. But let there be no misunderstanding. Luther enjoyed family life. His letters to his children are gems of understanding, encouragement, and concern. In one of the most moving of these, he tells of a wonderful garden for good children, with rosy apples, pears, cherries, and fine ponies with golden bridles and silver saddles. He wrote some of his loveliest hymns for his children. Following the labors of the day, the family often gathered together. Luther told them stories, played his lute, taught them songs and games. He composed his smaller catechism for children and set the example of leading family worship as the head of the house. On his trips, he always tried to remember to bring home something for the children. There were heart-wrenching moments. The death of Magdalena at the tender age of 14 tore him to pieces. His agonizing prayer was, "O God, I love her so, but thy will be done." To the little girl, his words were, "Magdalenchen, my little girl, would you like to stay with your father here, or would you be glad to go to your father in heaven?" Magdalena replied, "Yes, dear father, as God wills." The grief-stricken father held the little girl in his arms, and she passed away. For him was the pain as well as the pleasure of family life. Your family will test your stamina and frustrate you in many ways. But it will also help you to build character and teach you valuable lessons so that you can apply them to other people's life situations. 6. Make a place for recreation. As I sat at the head table of the banquet, I looked over the crowded tables of excited church members and realized this was a thriving church of which many ministers would be delighted to be the pastor. The pastor, a handsome young man in his mid-30s, sat by my side, and I asked, "Do you have any systematic plan of recreation?" A look of concern flitted over his face. "No, I don't. I know I should, but I've never been able to get round to it." He paused, then went on, "I used to try to take one day off a week, but that fell through." I think this young pastor with his thriving church is typical of many ministers today. I certainly hope that he continues on with his remarkable work. However, I felt constrained to warn him that it would be very important that he should provide himself with some type of recreational program. I know that every individual has his own peculiar needs, but a pastor really must have some plan of recreation. Recreation is meant to recreate men and women. Life as a pastor can be very demanding and can leave him uptight, and he needs opportunity to unwind. In a church I visited recently, I was told that after the staff meeting on Monday morning, the staff members adjourned to the gym where they played basketball together. They added that they felt that this had built a spirit of fellowship among them and at the same time had fortified their health. Every pastor should find out what type of recreation he enjoys and build it into his life, remembering that his body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. Here are some of the factors for consideration by people who might have difficulty about recreation. 1. Time spent in recreation is not lost. Some research shows that the period of rest after intensive activity often allows for incubation and leads to a new spurt of creativity. 2. The main element is change. Doing something different. You may work just as hard or harder at your recreational activities, but the change will be beneficial. 3. Hobbies have many possibilities. Of course, beware of getting into some field where there is so much competition that you're under emotional pressure to keep up. 4. Emotional programs may help us to develop some of our unused talents so that we can be well-rounded in the intellectual as well as the physical sense. Every pastor needs to have some definite time of recreation. 7. Stay mentally alert. The modern pastor certainly has to be a versatile person, and this versatility is nowhere more necessary than in his intellectual preparations. If he has attended college and seminary, many of his years were spent in intellectual pursuits. After seminary studies, he may be faced with the temptation to settle down and coast along, but if he does so at his own peril. If the pastor has not had this long preparation, he will need to remain intellectually alert because he will have fewer resources upon which to draw. J.D. Jowett, in his book on preaching, tells about the young minister who used to walk home with two of his deacons each Sunday evening following the evening church service. When the conversation lagged, he would occasionally lament, "Two more for next Sunday, two more for next Sunday." He was thinking of the sermons he must prepare for the following Lord's Day. Television performers frequently lament the voracious appetite of their medium and the way in which a weekly show gobbles up material. Well, if they think they have it bad, let them try preaching for a while. Two sermons on Sunday, one on Wednesday night, devotional in the Sunday school departments, speaking at the WMU, and perhaps several civic club events. All of these demand constant preparation. One pastor lamented, "I feel as if I'm a record player, turning myself on and off with great frequency." The haunting image of all these events requiring speeches, sermons, devotionals, and motivational talks is enough to threaten the emotional stability of any pastor. When a famous preacher of yesteryear described his sermon preparation, he said he was like a man sitting under an apple tree upon which there were apples in all stages of ripeness. Periodically, one of these apples would reach the stage where it was ready for picking, whereupon he'd reach up and pluck it. But if our minds are going to be productive, we need to be constantly fertilizing them. The unconscious is dynamic, but it must have material constantly fed into it. Many years ago, Bacon said that reading maketh a full man. If you're going to stay fresh, you must continually read so that you know what is going on in the world round about you and that you may be stimulated intellectually. Reading can help in other ways. Years ago, I had contact with a famous evangelist named Lionel B. Fletcher. Brother Fletcher was a dynamic, godly, gifted preacher, and I often quizzed him about his methods of ministry. At the conclusion of one tremendous gathering, I stood with him and then asked, "After a high hour like this, what do you do when you go home?" He smiled, then replied, "I go home and read a detective story." Well, he found his rest through his reading. No pastor can afford to neglect his reading. It will provide him with material, stimulate him intellectually, and provide him also with an emotional release and help in his emotional well-being. 8. Keep your goals in mind. One psychiatrist discussing the mental health of the minister suggested he will constantly clarify his objectives in order to maintain a strong sense of direction. A popular definition of maturity is the capacity to postpone pleasure. Like many popular sayings, it has more than a grain of truth in it. The maturing person looks ahead and plans for the future. As one psychologist expressed it, the mature person has long-range objectives, but also has in mind the steps that he will take in order to reach them. Dr. Bueller, in her study of outstanding personalities, concluded that each life was definitely ordered and steered towards a selected goal. These lives were characterized by aim and ambition. On the other hand, would-be suicides indicated that life had become intolerable because there was no goal to seek. Directionality and discipline are two essential elements of growth. The Christian religion is frequently criticized because of its emphasis on the future. It calls upon its followers to set up goals, to work towards objectives, and to sacrifice immediate pleasures for future satisfaction. However, all of these are factors in growth. As someone has said, without some sustained goals, a personality becomes childish. A minister may need to periodically reassess his goals. In the moments of youthful enthusiasm, the individual frequently sees himself as an evangelist. Later, it may be as a pastor. Still further down the line, he may see the unusual potentiality of the chaplaincy or a denominational position. At every stage of life, new possibilities appear, new doors open. Be ready to enter them. 9, see a perspective beyond your own self-interest. At birth, man is fundamentally self-centered. The Freudians say that the newborn child is mainly id, and consequently motivated by the pleasure principle. With the dawning of reality, the individual realizes the world does not exist for him alone. At some point in time, he comes to the realization, I am incomplete. A large part of the process of maturing is involved in the psychological journey from self-centeredness to other-centeredness. Allport calls the development an extension of self. He sees the experience of falling in love as an illustration. The lover discovers that all his personal urges and drives are focused on another person. Things of interest to the other person become of interest to him. Hitherto he felt self-sufficient. Now he discovers he needs another. This other person's welfare becomes paramount in his thinking, and his self is extended. The pastor, of all people, must have an interest in others, and it should be an interest which is kept in perspective. Empathy is a word used by psychologists to describe the process of understanding another individual's feelings and concerns. Empathy and sympathy are often confused, and in their psychological dictionary, English and English make a distinctive. While the process of empathy is primarily intellectual, emotion is not precluded, but is not the same emotion as that of the person with whom one has empathy. The parent may have empathy with the child's puny rage, feeling pity or amusement, whereas in sympathy, he would feel rage along with the child. The attitude in empathy is one of acceptance and understanding of an implicit, I see how you feel. As described, empathy is a hallmark of the mature person and highly desirable for the pastor. The Christian faith lays great emphasis upon community. The natural correlate of loving God is to love one's neighbour as oneself, and the celebrated golden rule bids Christians to think in terms of others. In one form of therapy, part of the process is for the troubled person to develop an interest in other people. So while the pastor is fulfilling his role in helping others, he may unwittingly be helping himself to develop his own emotional health. 10. Learn to know yourself. Socrates said, "I must first know myself." The whole process of maturing is wrapped up with developing self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is not easy to gain. Allport quotes a study in which, in a psychology class, 96% of the students thought they possessed better than average insight into their own personalities, with only 4% of them admitting a possible deficiency. It would be highly improbable that this was true to the facts of the case, but in humans, vanity often beclouds a sense of judgment. The psychological term for self-objectification is insight. Rogers describes insight as involving the perception of relationships, the acceptance of self, and the element of choice. In each of these, self-objectification plays a large part. Psychological investigation has shown a number of correlates of insight. People with insight are much less likely to judge other people by themselves. They are generally more intelligent than the average. And one of the least expected correlates is that people with insight generally have a good sense of humor. The maturing person is constantly developing the capacity to be able to stand off and look at himself, know himself, and be prepared to laugh at himself when necessary. The classical illustration is of Socrates attending a performance of Aristophanes' play, The Clouds. The play had in it a character wearing a face mask meant to ridicule Socrates. At the appropriate moment, when the audience was enjoying the caricature, Socrates stood and turned his head side on so the audience could compare his profile with the mask worn by the actor on the stage. Socrates was indicating his capacity to join with the people who were laughing at him. We have already noticed many of the factors that tend to blind the pastor to the reality of his own life, but there must come a moment of truth when he faces himself. Each of us has his own peculiar neurotic reaction, and he should become aware of himself. One man told about his struggle with temper, and he said, "I have learnt my signal system. When that funny feeling comes into my stomach, I say, 'Watch out, you're going to end up in trouble.'" Each pastor should learn his own signal system. And number 10, and in conclusion, maintain your devotional life. Those of us who deal with holy things are faced with the temptation to settle into a routine and forget the wonder of our calling. We all need to periodically charge our spiritual batteries. In Scotland, there is a bay called Gearloch, into which ships can sail. Here there is an absence of electrical interference so that the ship can set its compass and be sure that it is true. Every pastor needs a gear lock. Struggle to maintain your devotional life. Remember that they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint.